Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. Turkish-backed Syrian rebels have captured the symbolically important northern Syrian town of Debek from Islamic State militant as the U.S. and its European allies meet in London to discuss how to bring a halt to the Syrian conflict now in its sixth year. Debek is cited in Sunni prophecy as the site of an end-of-times battle between Christian forces and Muslims. Meantime, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry met in London with European allies to discuss the Syrian situation earlier. Yesterday, he met with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and regional players, but there were no breakthroughs. Secretary Kerry's spokesman Mark Toner on the U.S. focus for the talks.
The urgent need right now in front of us is some kind of cessation of hostilities, or at least a significant reduction in the level of violence, certainly in and around Aleppo. But more broadly, you know the framework we're working with them, which is to try to get a cessation. And once you get that cessation, then we can talk about next steps, which include getting negotiations back up and running in Geneva, as well as access for humanitarian assistance throughout Syria.
Hundreds of thousands of civilians are trapped in Aleppo without aid or a way to escape the war. The Iraqi Air Force dropped thousands of leaflets on Mosul warning residents of the coming offensive to liberate the city from the Islamic State terror group. The leaflet dropped late Saturday came after hours of an artillery bombardment by Iraqi and Kurdish forces and amid confusion over whether the full-scale assault on the country's second-largest city had in fact already kicked off. The United States and Britain and the UN peace envoy to Yemen called for Sunday for the warring partners in the country to immediately declare a ceasefire. U.S. Secretary of State spoke with reporters following that meeting in London.
Together, Boris Johnson and I, with the United Nations Special Envoy, Ismail al-Sheikh Ahmed, are calling today for the implementation of a ceasefire to be implemented by the parties as rapidly as possible, meaning Monday, Tuesday, but moving very rapidly.
Kerry said senior envoys had been in contact with the Yemeni's President Hadi and his internationally recognized government in exile and with the Iran-backed Houthi rebels who drove him from the country to push for peace talks. This is VOA News. U.S. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump conceded Sunday he is losing support among female voters, but blamed it on media accounts of women he says have falsely accused him of making unwanted advances on them. Trump also continued to claim the election is rigged in favor of his Democratic rival, Hillary Clinton.
The election is being rigged by corrupt media pushing false allegations and outright lies in an effort to elect Hillary Clinton president. But we are going to stop it. We are not going to back down.
Speaking to her reporters, Clinton talked about the imperative of winning the upcoming November 8th election.
We have to win in order to work together to demonstrate the positive, optimistic, confident, unifying vision of America that I believe in and that I think together we can demonstrate America's best days are still ahead of us.
Recent voter surveys show Clinton leads Trump with a 5.5 percentage point lead. The candidates square off in their third and final debate on Wednesday. South Korea has strongly condemned North Korea's latest missile launch attempt. Earlier, the U.S. military reported that North Korea tried to launch an intermediate-range ballistic missile Saturday, but the effort failed. In addition to already conducting an unprecedented two nuclear tests this year, Pyongyang has advanced its land base and submarine-based ballistic missile capabilities with numerous launches in the last 6 months. And the United Nations says around 370,000 Afghan refugees have returned home from neighboring Pakistan this year, with a significant spike since mid-July. The agency also notes, the refugee agency that is, the double the cash grant for voluntary returnees played a role in that jump. For details on much more news, I, Michael Brown, reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
Every country has rules that should be respected, the number of days the president should be in or out of the country.
Cameroonians demand to know the whereabouts of President Paul Biya.
The commission, the EFCC, is either not living up to expectation or its job has been usurped by the DSS, which is really not supposed to be so.
A supporter of Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari questions the ongoing fight against corruption.
800 million people still suffer from hunger in the world. Without food security and adequate nutrition for all, sustainable development simply cannot be achieved.
And October 16 is World Food Day. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Cameroonians have been asking where President Paul Biya is weeks after attending the UN General Assembly of Heads of State in New York last month. They said Mr. Biya left the capital Yaounde for New York on September 16, but has yet to return to Cameroon following the meeting of world leaders. For more regarding the whereabouts of the longtime Cameroonian leader, I reached parliamentarian Joseph Banajem from the opposition Social Democratic Front Party, or SDF.
They are legitimate. Every country has rules that should be respected, the number of days the president should be in or out of the country. Besides that, the ruler of the country is bound to render an account of his activities to the Cameroonian people. So it is very legitimate that people should be wondering where he is, and they should ask the government and him to render an account of his activities and how he administers the country.
Some people are saying that this is not a new thing. Although the constitution says that the president cannot stay out of the country for 40 consecutive days, he has to return, and that the call for or the demand for information about his whereabouts are neither here nor there, and that the president will be there possibly before the 40-day cut of the elapses. What do you say to that?
Well, we shouldn't stick only to the official date and time he should and should not be in the country. The thing is that he was elected. He assumed his responsibility as head of state to administer the country, make sure that the country is moving well. We have enormous problems in the country, and you need the leader to face those problems. Among them, the security of the country, the war we are facing with Boko Haram, developmental issues. You need to be in the country to see what is happening with our roads.
They are saying that the president has delegated authority to a host of his cabinet ministers, including the prime minister, and that the demand for his whereabouts is neither here nor there because the country is moving smoothly.
Is it moving smoothly? Because all the problems Cameroon has been facing, that delegation of power, somebody cannot account for totally. So that is not the proper answer, I think. We've been facing problems of corruption. You talked of the prime minister, you talked of ministers. How many of them are in prison? So many, which means that delegation of powers led them to do wrong things instead. So the head of state should totally give up himself to administer a country so that we, you know, you are in America. You know the number of Cameroonians who struggle to live and get to America and other countries. Why? Because they don't have a future in Cameroon. The development and employment and so on are not handled the way they should be, and Cameroonians face those problems. Whereas we are an extremely, extremely rich country. Our riches are not being managed properly and appropriately by those who are handling it. And the first person who should handle it well is the head of state. If he's not there, I am afraid Cameroonians are rightly requesting that he should pay a lot of attention to his duties as head of state.
Some Cameroonians have said that parliamentarians or lawmakers in the country should come up with some measure to force the government, or for that matter, the presidency, to give more information about the whereabouts of the president. Do you think that their call is well placed, and do you think parliament will come up with such a measure?
Well, those are people who do not know Cameroon well, because if you know Cameroon well, you know that our institutions, particularly parliament and now the Senate, are extremely weak. There has been a lot of manipulation in the electoral process to have what we call an overwhelming majority, and it is not that the few of us in the opposition who can force government to do the right thing. If we could fight hard and have institutions whereby parliament is a really independent institution, the judiciary is an independent institution, the press is an independent institution, then you could now talk of a parliament which, with their independence, could now ask a question or vote laws that could force the head of state to stand up on his feet. But for the moment, we have a crushing dictatorship which assumes all the other powers, that's legislative and judiciary. So for the moment, we cannot talk of parliament that will play the role which we want.
Joseph Banerjee is from the Opposition Social Democratic Front Party, or SDF. He spoke with me from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari promised to weed out corruption and implement policies to improve the living conditions of citizens. But critics say Mr. Buhari's policies are to blame for the poor prevailing economic outlook, which they said has plunged the country into recession. This following the sharp decline of global oil prices. Najatu Muhammad, a political activist and supporter of President Buhari, recently stopped by the VOA studios to talk about the fight against corruption, among other related issues in Nigeria.
I think this is one of the most important things that he has promised, and he is seen to be doing. But there is a lot to be desired.
Why do you say so?
I say so because at certain times, the commission, the EFCC, is either not living up to expectation, or its job has been usurped by the DSS, which is really not supposed to be so. And then you never get to see the end of the case.
Well, they said it's due process. And the legal process had to be followed.
Yeah, what are the legal processes? For instance, if we take what happened lately concerning these judges, I'm very happy about what has happened to these judges, because they are really the part. I mean, they are the cause of most of the problems in Nigeria, because the bottom line in Nigeria is that everything revolves around corruption. Nothing works because of the level of corruption in our country. Right. They've done a good job. But the thing is this. Who will now judge the judges? I can hear, and from some reports, that they are just giving them a soft landing. Because we don't see them being prosecuted.
Government says that it's following due process, and what? That is why the judges are going to be prosecuted.
No. You
and
see,
that report the
government
that
will
is
not
going to give them soft landing are not
the
true.
It is true, because a lot of cases, for instance, if you take the case of Dasuki, as per
you
what
mean the former national security chief, right?
Dasuki, as per what General Muhammad Buhari said himself. He said monies were brought out of the central bank with a piece of paper. In fact, he particularly said a paper from bread. You know this paper that
we put in the bread.
He said a paper that you put in bread, that instructions were written on that, and 40 billion was removed from the coffers of the central bank. 40 billion naira. So the question we now ask Buhari is this. What is the central bank governor still doing there? Why is the receiver in prison and the giver is still on his seat? These are the kind of things I'm talking about. Why is it that the DSS or the EFCC, as the case may be, are not tackling the issue of the central bank, the petroleum sector, the army, in spite of the reports. They are going after small fishes. It's not, you know, that is what, and then you never get to see the end of the case. So what is this fight about corruption?
You used to be a supporter, or for that matter, a sympathizer.
I am always a supporter. But I'm not a blind supporter.
Where is the divergence?
We supported General Muhammad Buhari because we believe that he will do justice to each and every person in our country. He swore with the Holy Quran that he will do things without fear or favor. But he is into nepotism. Nepotism itself is corruption. I did not put my life on the line for him to do this.
Well, his own wife recently said that President Muhammadu Buhari is not basically giving jobs to the boys, as it is said, those who helped him to gain power.
So
the issue of nepotism, basically, they said, is a non-starter.
Give me a few. Well, now, the real president is not General Muhammad Buhari.
Who is the real president?
The real president is his nephew, Mamandoura. Mamandoura is in charge in Nigeria. Because if you want anything done in government today in Nigeria, you have to go through him. And then we have to also understand that the chief of staff, Abba Kyari, is Mamandoura's boy. And he is there doing nothing but what they want for their personal interests.
I spoke to some officials of the government. They said these are just mere allegations.
They are
unfounded allegations.
No, they are not unfounded. They know that. But if somebody is working in government and that is where he makes what he makes, he can go against the government. But it is our responsibility as citizens of this country, of Nigeria, that have permanent rights over our leaders to say it as it is.
Some people are saying that you seem to be bitter. Hold on a second.
Yeah.
You seem to be bitter because you were not giving a sumptuous ministerial position.
People have a right to say what they want to say. But let me tell you, I have and always have been a businesswoman. I have never depended on government for survival. And I'm okay. I'm above average in Nigeria. So I'm okay. But people see government appointments in terms of what they get out of it. I'm not one of those people.
Najatu Muhammad is a Nigerian political activist and supporter of President Buhari. She spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. This month, workers in the telecom sector in Burkina Faso were on strike yet again, leading to phone and internet interruptions. The country only has one internet service provider, but as Bram Postumus reports from the capital, Ouagadougou, the days of the telecoms monopoly in Africa may be coming to an end.
5 billion CFA francs, that's $8.5 million. The telecom authority in Burkina Faso slapped this fine on Onatel, the country's single internet service provider, or ISP. The fine was a response to the lengthy strike at Onatel, which cut internet access across the country for more than a week. Failure to provide, said the authority. You pay. To get an idea of how bad things were, I got in touch with Aruna Wedrago, an IT specialist.
Comprenez qu'il y a des hommes d'affaires qui ne peuvent pas faire deux heures sans internet.
He had business people rushing to his internet cafe with contracts to sign, documents to send, last resort. But he couldn't help them. People outside this country just cannot imagine that there is no internet, he says, let alone for a week. He knows people so desperate they flew to Bamako in neighboring Mali just to get their emails. The problem? Onatel is a monopoly, as the political researcher Thomas Wedrago explains.
On était coupé des différents contacts et on n'a pas pu réaliser. Il y a eu énormément de pertes.
This whole country got cut off from the world because one company has management problems and relates badly to its workers. This cannot continue. What's to be done? Break it up. Open the market, he says. Burkina Faso is among a fistful of African countries that has to make do with just one or two ISPs like Onatel. Two bad things happen as a result, says IT specialist Aruna Wedrago.
C'est trop cher l'internet au Burkina, c'est trop cher, il faut dire. Et ce qui en plus de c'est pas trop cher, le débit n'est pas ça parce que dans le sous-région nous sommes un peu.
We pay too much for our internet connections, he says, and we get very little capacity. His solution? bring in the competition, and it's happening. A French company is laying its own fiber optic cable. Soon, Haruna hopes, Burkina Faso's internet agony will be over. Bring in more players, bring down the price, and you'll become Nigeria, or Mauritius, or indeed Kenya, the continent's star performer. The website Internet World Statistics says that 70% of Kenyans have an internet connection, usually with their smartphones. 20 African nations lag behind, with less than 10% access. They're either landlocked, have poor infrastructure, or a single ISP. As a result, the Central African Republic, Niger, Malawi, Burkina Faso, and others have a tiny customer base. Only big institutions, rich elites, and expats can afford a connection. But this business model is losing ground. The reason? Massively increased internet capacity, bringing down the price of a connection even in remote areas. 6 years ago, only 2 undersea fiber optic cables went to an African shore. Now, it's more than 10. Internet usage has tripled in the last 5 years, says the African Bureau of the Internet Society. So the message to the last remaining Onatels on the continent is twofold. One, get used to competition. Two, start responding to consumer demand. Together, they will make or break your business. Bram Posthumus for VOA News, Ouagadougou.
Turning to Southern Africa, analysts say Zimbabwe is heading towards a transition amid difficult times. Longtime leader Robert Mugabe is 92 years old and said to be in failing health. His ruling ZANU-PF party and the opposition are divided over who should succeed him and what kind of government should come next. And that uncertainty comes amid a severe drought, food shortages, and a declining economy. A recent symposium at the Washington-based U.S. Institute of Peace looked at some of the challenges facing the country. VOA's William Eagle has more from Washington.
Zimbabwe is in flux. There are regular protests, especially in the capital, over currency and food shortages, unemployment, and alleged government corruption and mismanagement. But observers say an effectual political solution may not be soon in coming. President Mugabe and ZANU-PF have been in power for 36 years, but the party is breaking into factions, and at least one former member, one-time Vice President Joyce Mujuru, has formed her own party, Zimbabwe People First. The longtime opposition Movement for Democratic Change has new competitors, including more than a dozen new parties and youth-driven protest movements inspired by social media. All are preparing for national elections in 2018. The participants, at a recent panel discussion in Washington, agreed that Zimbabweans and the international community alike would favor a soft landing to a post-Mugabe future. One participant at the recent symposium was Alex Vines, head of the Africa program at the London-based policy institute Chatham House. Vines said the West has become complacent and has lost contact with the different factions within the ruling party and also with the military.
If we get into a really uncertain, unpredictable security situation in Zimbabwe, it will be the military that will have a role in managing that process. And I tend to still believe that the military will play a key role in whatever happens as a kingmaker, in whatever coalition or inclusive political entity that might come out with opposition and parts that have split from ZANU. So the military is really, really central here.
Symposium delegates also urged the U.S. and its allies to revisit sanctions on Zimbabwe, targeting more than 80 people and 50 groups linked to human rights violations, corruption, and mismanagement. They say the sanctions list is outdated and includes some government critics like opposition leader Joyce Mujuru. Also taking part in the seminar was the former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs under the Obama administration, Ambassador Johnny Carson. He said the U.S. government had considered lifting sanctions in order to encourage democratic reforms. He suggested that the U.S. continue maintaining them as a way to encourage democratization and good governance in Zimbabwe, although those efforts have not succeeded so far.
In 2010 and 11, we worked very closely with the South Africans, looking for solutions. And in fact, said to the South Africans as a part of the efforts there, that we, and I certainly would have been willing to do everything possible to pull down the sanctions if the Zimbabweans were willing to do one or two significant things in the run-up to the elections.
Carson said U.S. ambassadors to Africa should continue to reach out to Zimbabwe's business community, an idea also backed by Dr. Whitney Schneidman, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
Sunday, October 16 is World Food Day. While the date originally marked the founding of the UN Food and Agriculture Organization in 1945, it later became an official event celebrating efforts to end hunger and malnutrition. The World Food Day slogan this year is "Climate is Changing." VOA's Jody Kapwa has more.
FAO Director General José Graziano da Silva warns that higher temperatures and erratic weather patterns are already undermining the health of soils, forests, and oceans. That, he says, puts food security at risk.
Food is the most basic human right, yet nearly 800 million people still suffer from hunger in the world. Without food security and adequate nutrition for all, sustainable development simply cannot be achieved.
De Silva says droughts and floods have become more frequent and intense, and outbreaks of climate-related diseases and pests have become more common.
We have seen firsthand their terrible impacts in these past months as El Niño hit Africa, Asia, and other parts, especially the dry corridor of Central America.
The FAO chief says natural disasters, like Hurricane Matthew, are more likely to occur as global temperatures rise.
As usual, the poorest and the hungry are those who suffer the most. The vast majority of them are small family farmers that live in rural areas in developing countries.
De Silva adds climate change adaptation and mitigation require appropriate technologies, knowledge, markets, information, and investigations. International Fund for Agricultural Development President Kenyayo Nwanze calls for the protection of smallholder farmers.
If we are ever to break the cycle of poverty and hunger, we must focus our efforts on building the resilience of smallholders. Why? Because 3/4 of the world's poorest and undernourished people live in the rural areas of developing countries. Because most of these women and men depend on small-scale agriculture for their lives and livelihoods.
World Food Program Executive Director Ertharin Cousin says humanitarian agencies and nations have a responsibility to move beyond disaster relief to managing climate change risk.
The planet's most vulnerable people are demanding and depending on us to get this right. Our shared commitment to achieving zero hunger depends on us getting this right. Climate change is already stretching the humanitarian system financially and operationally. In 2013, over 90% of the natural disasters were climate-related.
Cousin says without concerted action, hard-won development gains will be reversed, and millions more will know the misery of hunger. She adds that climate change, food security, and economic development are not separate challenges, but different facets of the same challenge. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. And it's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In the African Champions League, South Africa's Mamelodi Sundowns beat Zamalek of Egypt 3-0 in Saturday's first leg of the African Champions League final in Atteridgeville on the outskirts of Pretoria. This is a great advantage for Sundowns, because not since 2010, when TP Mazembe beat Esperance of Tunisia 5-0, has the club built such an emphatic first-leg lead in the final. Anthony Lafour and Tebogo Langman made it 2-0 at halftime, with the third coming just after the break. Sundowns are now firm favourites for the second leg in Alexandria, where they will seek to win their first continental trophy and become only the second South African side to win Africa's top club prize. If Sundowns lift the trophy next weekend, it will complete a remarkable turnaround in this competition for the South African club. They were knocked out in an early qualifying round by AS Vita Club, only to be brought back in when Vita Club were disqualified for fielding an ineligible player. The second leg in Alexandria takes place on Sunday, October 23rd. Meanwhile, European countries will not be able to host the 2026 World Cup because of FIFA's rotational policy. It means the previous two host confederations, Europe in 2018 and Asia in 2022, are barred from bidding. The 2026 tournament would involve 40 or 48 nations after world governing body FIFA agreed to study in greater detail the options to expand the tournament from its 32-team format. The proposals will be made at FIFA's next meeting on January 9, 2017, and that's according to FIFA President Gianni Infantino. Infantino took charge of FIFA in February, and one of his election promises was to increase the number of teams at the World Cup finals to 40. However, this month, the 46-year-old Italian proposed increasing that to 48 countries, with 32 taking part in a preliminary knockout round in the host country and the winners joining 16 seeded teams in the group stages. And in tennis, Britain's Andy Murray beat Roberto Bautista Agut in straight sets to win the Shanghai Masters and edge closer to Novak Djokovic in the world rankings. The Scot recovered from a stutter in the first set to win 7-6, 7-1, 6-1 against the Spanish world number 19.
I've never had success like I've had the last few months in my career. So, you know, to keep that going, I'm aware it's going to be a difficult thing to do, and I need to keep myself motivated and be smart with my schedule and my time off as well. But I believe I can get there. I definitely believe I can get there, and you know, these last few months have proved that to me, and yeah, I'll give it my best shot to do it, because I may never get another chance.
Andy Murray speaking immediately after winning the Shanghai Masters early Sunday. This is Murray's sixth title of the year. The 29-year-old is 1,915 points behind Djokovic for 2016, increasing his hopes of finishing the year as world number one. It's the third time he has won the Shanghai Masters, which gives him 1,000 ranking points. Murray, who also won the China Open on October 9th, has now won his past 23 sets over the two tournaments and the recent Davis Cup tie with Argentina. Bautista Agut beat Djokovic in the semi-finals. He has now won four ATP singles titles, and after the game he said he had given it his all.
Not easy for me to handle all the emotions I had this week, and for me it was not easy to feel perfect on the court in the first final appearance in Master 1000. But I think I gave everything on the court today as every week. But I think I could play better tennis today.
Batista Agut lost to Brit Kyle Edmund in Beijing last week, but had bounced back in style in Shanghai, not dropping a set on his route to the final, which included the biggest victory of his career against Djokovic in Saturday's semi-finals. And that's it for this edition of Netland Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African Sports Nightline, Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Enjoy.
because them try to underrate us.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN and Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. With utter bewilderment, anger, and frustration, the political class in Nigeria is currently engaged in a bitter debate regarding remarks made by Mrs. Aisha Buhari, the wife of President Buhari of Nigeria, while her husband was in an official visit to Germany. Mrs. Buhari gave an interview to the Arusa service of the BBC. In that interview, she frontally criticized the composition of her husband's government. She asserted that out of 50 officials, she did not know about 45 of them, and wondered why members of the party had not been fully included. When President Buhari was questioned in Berlin about his wife's comments, he unfortunately made remarks which have received criticism. He said that he had better knowledge of the politics of Nigeria and that Mrs. Buhari belonged to the kitchen and other rooms. This remark was so unfortunate because the international community has been striving to promote the concept of gender equality, and also currently, global attention is focused on the United States political campaign for the presidency, where the topic of respect for women have taken a central stage. perhaps President Buhari will find a way to not only apologize to his wife, but to the people of Nigeria. Nevertheless, we should not lose sight of the core of Mrs. Buhari's criticism. She believed that only those party members who had worked tirelessly for the election of her husband should have been in the cabinet. What she said was similar to earlier comments and criticism made by members of the All Progressive Congress APC, saying that a small group have hijacked the government of President Buhari. This is also true in many parts of Africa, where there is a strong belief that those in the government should be loyal party members, and only they can promote the interest of the state. This is rather unfortunate, because much of the problem of Africa is linked to this erroneous concept. One should take account of what happened in Britain in the 19th century at the height of the British Empire. A renowned Prime Minister, William Gladstone, coined the expression that at a time of crisis and importance of the people of England, what was needed was a ministry or cabinet of all the talents, and he governed by that principle. Recently, Gordon Brown, who had succeeded Tony Blair, tried to revive that concept of a cabinet of all the talents. But many in Africa do not agree. This commentator could remember a time when the late President Kabar of Sierra Leone, who had considerable international experience, particularly as personnel officer of the UNDP, tried to bring about a cabinet of all the talents in Sierra Leone. He lost the support of his party, who believed that only those in the parties should be brought into government. And it is time that when Africa is going through so many crises and having so much problems, this concept that only party members should be called upon to assist the country should be set aside. All over Africa, there are criticism, not only by scholars and the media, that there is a tendency in Africa to put square pegs in round holes. So this matter should be debated in Nigeria and given some consideration as to why is it that there is so much concern that Buhari is going out to look for people of competence. Mrs. Aisha Buhari said that when those people that she did not know were questioned as to why they are involved with the government, they always say they are not politicians. And her response was, if they were not politicians, what are they doing in the government of politicians? So this is one matter we should discuss. Forget about the unfortunate remarks of President Buhari, because this is not where Africa should go. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Michael Dubinsky, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders saying, the stream said that because it has nobody to direct it, that's why it goes in a zigzag way. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. Economic progress for Nigeria's most vulnerable population improved in October, thanks to a new agreement between the United States of America and the government of Nigeria. On October 5th, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, announced $92.73 million in additional developmental assistance to support the five-year $2.3 billion agreement signed with the Nigerian government in 2015. The assistance agreement announced in Abuja brings the total of developmental assistance provided to $474.74 million. This funding will continue to help Nigeria reduce extreme poverty in a more stable democratic society. Activities will stimulate inclusive economic growth, promote a healthier, more educated population, and strengthen good governance. We are pleased to contribute additional funding in support of the agreement signed with the Nigerian government in 2015, said USAID Mission Director Michael Harvey. With their leadership, we know this funding will have a significant impact on the well-being of Nigerians, he added. In an effort to align Nigeria's development plans with sector-specific strategies, USAID collaborated with the Nigerian Ministry of Budget and National Planning, the Nigerian Ministries of Health, Agriculture, Power, and Education, and state-level government counterparts to structure the agreement, which is in place until 2020. In addition to the developmental funding, the United States provides humanitarian assistance to people affected by the ongoing conflict and severe food insecurity in Nigeria and throughout the Lake Chad Basin. Since fiscal year 2015, the United States has provided more than $366 million in humanitarian assistance and continues to be the single largest bilateral humanitarian donor to the region. About USAID. USAID partners to end extreme poverty and promote resilient, democratic societies while advancing our security and prosperity. In its partnership with Nigeria, the United States strengthens social stability through social services, supports transparent and accountable governance, promotes a more market-led economy, and enhances Nigeria's capacity as a responsible regional and trade partner. The United States is proud to work with its partner Nigeria to promote the prosperity and well-being of the people of Nigeria, the region, and the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is VOA News.